name's Louis Trickle, L-O-U-I-S, Louis. May 16th, 1912. I was born the year the Titanic went down. That went down. I came up. But then, as Jimmy Carter once said, who said life was fair? So, in any event, that's the ticket.
You're not Louis Trickle.
Well,
to most people.
I wish it were what you think it was, but it wasn't.
And his nickname, borrowed from a 1930s trilogy he loved, James Farrell's Studs Lonergan books.
But one time it did get me in trouble because of that nickname. Working came out, and I got a letter from a librarian somewhere in Georgia. I remember her name, Sylvia Cooper. She says, you know, I have volunteers working for me, but one of them is a spy for the Reverend Jerry Falwell, and they're spying on me. They're not taking what they call dirty books with dirty ideas and words. And so one day he comes up to me and says, Miss Cooper, a request came for a book. And I said, we do not carry pornographic literature. And she said, what's the name of the book? He said, I believe it's called Working Studs by Trickle.
Studs' family moved to Chicago when he was a child, where his parents operated a rooming house on Wells and Grand. Soon, he was off to the University of Chicago, where he received a law degree. But Studs wasn't interested in a career in law. Instead, he was attracted by the stage and soon found his way into radio.
The owner of the station, Bernie, said, do anything you want, you got an hour a day. And so I began to interview people by accident, and that's how it all happened.
As the host of the Studs Terkel program on WFMT, that show, which featured wide-ranging interviews of everyone from musicians to scholars to community activists, lasted for an astounding 45 years.
So I'd used to read short stories of Flannery O'Connor or John Cheever or Ring Lardner or Chekhov and do documentaries. Sometimes I went on the train to Washington, 1963 March, led by King. Or some kids I heard, a social worker says, these kids are having a fight over a swimming pool in a mixed neighborhood. Greek kids, Italian kids, black kids, and Hispanic kids. And I talked to them. And one of the questions, what would you do if you were God? What would you do if you were God? And the responses were fantastic. One guy says, I don't want the job. Who wants that job? You mean I got to make... That sort of stuff I would do. And that led to the books.
Terkel would go on to write 12 oral histories, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Good War from 1985.
He traveled across the country interviewing people from all walks of life about war, about their jobs, and about their dreams. His conversations with the prominent and the uncelebrated have become a map of 20th century America.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we visit the work and life of Studs Terkel, who died October 31st, 2008, at the age of 96. Stay tuned. When I first started traveling around the country, I was lucky enough to already know about Studs Terkel. When I had wound up in Chicago, I would make sure to listen to his radio show on WFMT, reveling in the cute old man voice with the radical ideas and the heart of gold, who made me feel like I could know humanity and Chicago while just sitting and listening, taking it all in. He started in radio the second half of his life, in 1952, and kept at it until 1997. He was one of the first people I heard talk about McCarthyism and the blacklist.
Then comes Bing, the local legionnaires what did it. My name never appeared, by the way, on thing called Red Channels. You heard of Red Channels. In fact, I was a little hurt at first. You see, here are the names of people I admire. There's Arthur Miller, there's Zero Mostel, there's Lillian Hellman, the various actors. I realize I'm not on it. And I attribute that to New York parochialism. It's like my being a dowager not making the social register. Now, I admit I was funny, but it wasn't that funny. When you get right down, it wasn't that funny. Because there's still the local guy named, his name was Clamage, had a flower shop. And he made his career, he wanted to get in the paper so bad that he wouldn't attack. There were school teachers blacklisted and all that, and people working in the factory. He didn't want them. He wanted to be called celebrities. He'd read the columns. I was his favorite pigeon because I'm in town. I remember I signed all these things. Not only I signed these things, I also chaired meetings. I did. I was MC some of these gatherings, you know, on Jim Crow especially, so, or stop the poll tax, all these things. And so a guy comes in from New York. Now I'm hot, right? And all of a sudden, bang, a guy comes up from New York, and they gather their people from Chicago who are all friendly. And so he says, your name's on this list. I says, yeah, you know. And will you, you know, the communist sign? I said, I did say a funny crack. You say communists start these petitions. Suppose they come out, these communists, against cancer. Do we come out for cancer? And they said, that's not very funny. And so that was it. And finally, I'm out. And my wife was a social worker, luckily enough. But I pick a buck here. It wasn't that pleasant. However, I look upon it, you know. If it weren't for that, I would not have gone on this FM station, WFMT, that was classical music. I would not have interviewed these people. I would not have done interviews that finally led me to do interviews with the books and all. So I'm not suggesting you be on the blacklist. But however, were it not that, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today.
Hey, Elliot Jackson. Well, I told you about I picked up records, jazz records, and I picked up Wonder Wonder as a jazz disc jockey doing that program called Wax Museum. I played my hand, yeah. I played it because one day I walk in this record shop and I hear this record, 10-inch reel. But move on up a little higher. I never heard a voice like that. It's two sides of a 10-inch reel. And so I go to the church to see her, and I play her records. I played her records again on my wax museum. And to this day, Mahalia says, and you said that I'm the one who brought the white audience to Mahalia, which to some extent is true. I guess it's true. I did play continuously, play Mahalia, and on the Studs Place. So now I've been blacklisted, right? And I have worked for you. Now, Mahalia's got a show on radio, CBS Radio, Mahalia Jackson Sings, Friday nights, on CBS Network Radio. And she wants me to be the host and narrator. And so, okay, we're doing the program, and I remember we can agree that His Eyes on the Sparrow will be her theme song. So we're rehearsing. Well, there's a live audience, you know, at the Wrigley Building. It's a little theater then. It seats about 500 people, 400 people. And they're live. They come in mostly white. There's some black. And they come in, and the show is, say, 7 o'clock at night. Maybe it was 8, 7 o'clock Chicago time. And it's about 4 o'clock. We're rehearsing. We're rehearsing with a quartet. And I'm going over the script, going over the record here. And a guy comes in from New York, another guy from New York. Last time NBC was, now CBS. He's on stage. We're rehearsing. He comes up to me and says, oh, Mr. Turkle, I'm glad you're here. You have to sign this. You sign this. And sign what? Sign. And it's a loyalty oath. That is not for CBS. I said, are you out of your mind? I don't sign these things. What do you mean? Am I the... It's for you. You mean I'm the only... Oh, I should be honored. I'm the only one asking. They didn't find a word. I don't say. And my head is passing by. My head knows what she says. Hey, baby, is that what I think it is? That cat. She's going to the piano. I says, yeah. You want to sign it? I says, no. Okay, let's rehearse. So, oh, pardon me, Miss Jackson, says he. And she's going to Mildred Falls, the accompanist. Goes in. Miss Jackson went, well, he has to sign it. He just told you he doesn't want to sign it. Yeah, but he has to. And he said, look, you tell them in New York, if they fire Studs Terkel, then they better find another Mahalia Jackson. You know what happened? Nothing. He disappeared. He disappeared. The show went on till the end of its run. What's the moral of it? Mahalia Jackson, that one moment, had more guts and little thing, more American than William Paley, David Sarnoff, all the network heads, channel heads, all the agency sponsors, all rolled into one. Because she said no. All they had to do was say, no. The emperor had no clothes. But they didn't do it. So that's the moral. Mahalia Jackson, my saying no, but her saying the big no. That's it. That's what it's about. It's not about America. It's about cowardliness and cravenness. It's about having a little spunk of some sort of spine. That's what it's about. And that's what I hope I'm and some goofy extent about.
These are some of my favorite moments of Studs, mostly about Chicago, race, and how to fit into a culture that tries at every turn to stifle what makes us truly unique and human, our voices and our stories.
In Chicago, like a weird radio columnist, Studs Terkel, Life magazine reporters, New York Times reporters, Village Voice reporters.
This was recorded by a Pacifica radio reporter at the protests of the Chicago Democratic Convention in 1968.
In a way, tear gas forces you to react. It forces you to react emotionally to what's going on in the society.
Well, I don't know. It suddenly turned into some enormous comedy. It suddenly turned into a great comedy. Like it's like a class reunion of all sort of tendencies in Chicago for many years, and international tendencies in this lobby of the hotel across from the park where everybody ran to escape when the streets got filled with gas. The poor Time Life photographer was flat on his back, having his picture taken, weeping out on his ass with tear gas.
I couldn't think of the words to use.
My city, Chicago. So we go to the park often for joy and for beauty, and tonight I never saw as much ugliness and stupidity and brutality.
This is... I can't hear. Oh, this is Studs Terkel that Bob is interviewing. Studs is the author of the best-selling book, Division Street America. Excuse us for interrupting and for our technical problems. We just wanted to identify Mr. Terkel.
He's famous, the boys in blue. Never dreamed that Daly would be this brutish or stupid. I heard about last night. I wasn't there, but I thought I'd go tonight just to enjoy the evening air, you know? And there was a cross. Obviously, being near a cross is very dangerous these days. And there were songs, and there were young ministers and kids enjoying themselves. I thought it'd be a nice, fun... Lincoln Park, by the way, is a beautiful park near the lakefront, and quite lovely. And then came the voice over the speaker warning to us, and then came our city's finest. And as my friend James Cameron, a visitor from England, says, he's over there, says it looked like Agincourt for a moment. And there they were, all lined up in battle helmets, and there were just young people, unarmed, just looking at them, really, a little furious. And the cops came along, and then came the tear gas. First time I'd never tasted it before. And so it came twice, and but I guess the thing that moved me most, though, were the kids and the young ministers. Kids putting Vaseline on your eyes and giving you blankets, some really something, you know. And the young ministers giving you advice, and some of you guys, I guess this is a double strain in our society, the Neanderthal man of the 20th century and the possibility for enlightenment. And so I think the lines were really, the issue was joined, I think, tonight in my favorite park, Lincoln Park, Chicago. On this beautiful autumn evening, August what? August whatever it is, 20.
I'm not sure the date, and that means that I forgot to send LBJ a birthday card this year. It's his birthday.
It's on LBJ's birthday. I haven't thought about that. Which I think is quite appropriate, which is, as it should be, I think, for all of our enlightenment. And maybe this was good for those who were there to see it. Maybe it was good. I'm just wondering about our visitors from different countries who are here. They're learning about this new world. That suddenly becomes so old, almost primordial. But I enjoy the company very much, the company I'm with right now. As a phrase, Brendan B. and Fraser can use this, you know, talking about the amphitheater, which the kids called anti-life, and I guess they're right at that, and life that is here. Brendan B., you say, you have your friends and I have mine. I might say, they have their friends and I have mine. I found my friends here tonight.
Thank you. That was Studs Terkel.
This train bound for Washington, Wednesday, August 28, 1963, 800 free passengers. Here are some of their words, thoughts, and dreams.
Well, it appeals to me that we are going somewhere to get something. When you say go on the train, it means you're going someplace. And this train means a whole lot to me. But we are going to get something good.
At the B&O Depot, Chicago, 3:30, Tuesday afternoon, just before departure.
But I placed importance on this train simply because it represents so much.
It means an opportunity to earn a living in my country.
Well, to me, it means that my relatives and people who aren't related to me, after I'm gone, or while I'm still here, we'll have a better future and more secure life than what I've had.
Well, going back to childhood, when I used to travel from mid-North Dakota to mid-Canada in Fitzroy Harbor, Ontario, every summer. It meant going places. It was a means whereby you got from one place to another. You went from a toward a goal, and you arrived at a goal. That's what a train meant to me, in a sense, too, going home.
Well, a train means moving on, moving forward. But one day all of us will be dead. But after we're gone, there will be these millions of little children who are being deprived of opportunities. The opportunities are there.
Success is a cinch by the inch. It's just hard by the yard.
Train is the movement. It's the movement of one person or people from one place to another. It's dynamic. It's forceful. It always has a certain destination. It always reaches a certain point. And I hope this train is going to reach freedom.
Did you mention high school? What about high school teachers? What about teachers? Well, let's ask the alumnus first. Andrew Fash.
In what way, teachers?
Well, who are they? Do they dig what's going on, the teachers at Gage Park High School?
I've recently revisited Gage Park High School, and I saw many of the teachers that I had there. Many of the older teachers have retired by now. This, I think, is good in a way. I mean, this is a process that is natural and should always occur.
Ron?
Well, most of the teachers, most of the older ones are leaving, and now we have teachers that are fairly young now. And, I guess most of them are beginning to see the problem that the kids are having. They're trying to, in a way, in the classroom, trying to solve the problem. They're opening discussions more often. I mean, before it was the teacher said, you know, you sit there, and now we've just, classrooms have opened up. We've had discussions on the racial problems.
Yes, you see, when I was going to Gage, there were no black students. Consequently, there was no problem, you see. Of course, the problem was always there, but it didn't have
it
to be...
It wasn't visible.
Yeah, it didn't have to be dealt with.
John Schneider, you...
Well, the teachers tried, but they don't go about it in the right way, I don't think. A lot of times, they're afraid of what can happen to them. They bow to the kids because they're afraid that, you know, they heard all these stories about all these other teachers from other schools getting beat up and shot and everything. A lot of them, I think that about half of them are still pretty prejudiced, I believe. Mm-hmm. That they just try to put it in the back. They try to forget about it. They don't like to talk about it, you know. They figure, you know, let it alone, it'll go away.
Do they talk, some of the older teachers, about the good old days when there were no black kids? They don't, not saying those words, when the kids were well-mannered.
Not really, no. They don't talk about it.
My peers that graduated with me from Gage Park, several of them now are teachers themselves. They've finished their college and all the requirements, and they're teaching in the inner city schools, and their lines are completely integration-oriented. I've never seen more liberal people in my life. Now, these are kids like myself who grew up, always lived in the Gage Park area, and these kids are coming back to live in the Gage Park area, even though they're teaching in another area of the city. Now, where did these kids get this idea, right? Did they discover that in college? I think perhaps they did. They certainly didn't get that at Gage Park High School because we didn't have that type of problem then. But yet they've come back with the idea that...
No. So whatever they got, you feel they got outside rather than in this community,
yes.
The high school. What are your thoughts on it, Beverly? Teachers and students.
Well, the teachers, they don't say much because, well, like John said, they're afraid of what can happen to them. But I don't think it's mostly what will happen to them by the students, but what the administration can do to them.
Amen to that.
And, well, I had one teacher while I was in John's class. And like you said, we only talked on it a couple times. And it seemed like he kept on beating around the bush about it. He wouldn't give his complete thoughts on the matter. He'd just try to get our views on it and try to avoid it for himself. And we'd ask him something, and he'd say, I don't want to discuss it. And, I mean, what can they do to you? If you want to speak your mind, speak it.
I mean, what can they fire you is what can happen to you if you're a teacher.
fits me.
And that takes away your livelihood. If you have a family to support, you're going to be quiet.
But I can't see why they have that. I mean, in the Constitution, they give us the right of speech. And why, in the school administration, should they take it away from us?
That was a panel discussion on racial integration at Gage Park High School, located on the southwest side of Chicago. Before that was This Train, interviews with participants on their way to a civil rights march recorded in August 1963 and produced by Studs Terkel.
I was in all these programs, the scripts were all the same, and then became a disc jockey by accident, then became a commentator by accident, and thanks to Andre Shiprin, a remarkable publisher, began to do these books based upon conversations with people not celebrated. You know, I've always been influenced by a poem by Bertolt Brecht, and this poem, in a sense, is my credo, or provides it. Bertolt Brecht, a free penny opera with Kurt Weill, he said, well, for example, when you ask who built the pyramids, our first reaction is the pharaohs. Well, the pharaohs didn't lift a finger, and the fingernails of Mrs. Pharaoh were as immaculately manicured as Elizabeth Taylor's. It was built for centuries by anonymous slaves. Who were they? And Brecht asked the poem, when the Seven Gates of Thebes was built, who carried those rocks from one place to another? When the Chinese Wall was built, where did the masons go for lunch? When Caesar conquered Gaul, we got that in Latin 1, all Gaul divided into three parts. When Caesar conquered Gaul, was there not even a cook in the army? And the big one is this. He asks, when the Armada sank, the Spanish Armada. I remember, I know that date, we got it in school, 1588, which is as indelibly imprinted in our minds as 1492 or 1776. 1588, we're told, Sir Francis Drake conquered the Spanish Armada. Did he do it by himself or what? And Brecht asked the question, when the Armada sank, we read that King Philip of Spain, wept. And here's the big question, were there no other tears? And so the history I try to, I try to find out those people who shed those other tears. Who are these people who through centuries have shed those other tears? In other words, who made this world go round? Whose names we don't know about or of.
I'm from the Midwest, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Chicago's little sister. We share a lot of characteristics, blue collar, proud union history, segregated neighborhoods, and rich immigrant enclaves. I didn't know about Studs Terkel until fairly recently. Even when I heard Aaron talk of him fondly, I didn't grasp that I was following in his footsteps each time I took out the recorder to talk to someone I met on a street corner or go into some old rabble-rouser's living room. I needed only to sit down and listen to his recordings, and then it hit me. On a recent visit to my hometown, I found a copy of Studs Terkel's book, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. It came out in 1992. The following excerpts are included in the book. Little Dovey Thurman.
You know, living in the projects and all who lived in there were black. And so I was like in a little isolated area. Most black people have lived in an isolated area one time or another. And you only come in contact with other nationalities when you had to go for hospitals or to school sometime. And then the school wasn't as integrated as they are now. So
you saw a doctor while you were in the hospital.
Nurses and doctors.
Or go to court sometimes, saw a lawyer.
Yeah, or teachers or someone like that.
But then that experience in Uptown, the first poor whites, ever saw. And you worked with them?
Yeah, I did. I worked with John. I was organized by Rennie Davis.
Rennie Davis.
My aunt and I had gone to the welfare office. I was trying to get supplementary aid for my children because our allotment check wasn't enough. So I found out I could get supplementary aid here, and I went down on Lincoln. That's when the welfare office was on Lincoln Avenue. And Rennie and some more of the organizers were out passing out leaflets.
And one I remember real well because I hated the welfare system. As a child growing up on the welfare system, I encountered white caseworkers. And in dealing with white caseworkers, I didn't like white caseworkers. I thought all caseworkers were the same because we mostly had white ones then. And she used to tell my grandmother, who, that's a picture of her right there. Mm-hmm. See, she looks like she's white.
Mm.
And she
light
said,
light skin.
Yeah, well, she's mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Irish and black and Indian. And they would tell her she needed to give me back, this little black child, back to her mother. And that would make my grandmother so angry.
Oh, she said to your grandmother, who was light-skinned,
yeah,
give you, who was blacker than your
mm-hmm,
grandmother,
mm-hmm.
back to her mother.
Mm-hmm. Back to my mother.
Back to your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And your grandmother got mad.
Oh, she chased out of the house with a knife. Yeah, she did, and turned red. Boy, she said, that's my black baby. And I always hated welfare because she had to lick behind them. She couldn't tell them how she felt or else they cut our check off. And I said, if I ever get big, Mama, when I get grown, I'm going to whoop me some caseworkers up. I always want to do that.
Whip one of them up.
Yeah, I didn't like the way they did my mama. And then I went, so I went to the welfare office and I saw this leaflet that Rennie Davis passed to us. And it said, are you tired of late checks, no checks, midnight raids, caseworker harassment? Come to a meeting. And I couldn't believe they were saying this openly because, you know, you wasn't allowed to do that then. They cut your check off. And I told my aunt, I say, look at this. And she read it. She said, oh, we need to go there. That's Big W. She said, we need to go there. I'm tired of all
this. That's your aunt, Big W.
Yeah. And I said, she said, you want to go? I said, yeah. So Rennie came back to the car after we come out the welfare office and invited us, come on over. Said, we're having a meeting tonight, and you should come. And we're fighting. We're tired. Aren't you tired of this? And we said, yeah. So I hate them. And then we went, and the first observation I got when I walked in the office, and I think it was over here on Argyle or either Ainsley, one of the two. No, it was on Ainsley. And at that time, I walked in, and I seen this smoky room I'll never forget. Everybody seemed like they were smoking, and it was a dim light, and it was a group of people sitting around. But I didn't see nobody black in there.
This was what? This was the what office was?
This was Join. That night we went to
itself.
Yeah, we went to the meeting that
night.
Saw
nobody black.
Nobody's black. And we said, you think it's all right to go in? And we kind of hesitated, you know, because we didn't know anything too much about Uptown at that time.
I mean, you hesitated going in because not accustomed to being welcomed by whites.
Well, I wasn't used to being around all them white people.
Yeah.
Uh-uh.
So, yeah.
And they was looking like at us real strange.
They were.
Yeah, and so we looked, and then we saw Rennie. And he said, come on in, sisters. He said, these are the people I met at the welfare office today. And then I invited them over. And everybody, they had stopped talking and was just looking. And we went in and they made us welcome to sit down. It was me, my aunt, and my uncle. He's dead now. And they just stared at us. And so Mary Hockenberry was carrying on a conversation about welfare. And they asked me, did I have anything to say? And I stood up and I made a couple of statements that I'm sick of this kind of welfare system, and I don't know what to do about it, but I want to fight too. I say it's doing the same to all of us, just like that. That's my first encounter ever speaking to a group of people. And I got a big hand, which was shocking to Rennie, because he said all the time black people would try to come in, and it was mostly black guys, and they would get to fighting. They wouldn't let them in, you know.
And why wouldn't they let them in?
I found later, it was racist. There was a lot of racism going on.
Mm.
They didn't like blacks at all.
Who was it, the Joint people?
Not the Joint people, but the people they were organizing, the Southern whites.
Oh, the Southern whites
right.
were there. Also on welfare.
Right.
I see.
And they were the ones who Joint was bringing
and they applauded you.
Right.
And then you realize Southern whites are applauding you.
Well, I looked because I was surprised. I never spoke before.
Mm-hmm.
And so were Rennie and them. They were really amazed that they accepted that speech. So they invited us to come back again the next meeting night. And so we did. We said, okay. And so after the meeting, Rennie walked us to the car. He said, come back. They must really like you. They've never reacted like that to black people before. And I said, I've never seen so many white people. And they poor. He said, didn't you know it was poor white people? I said, no. I've never seen any poor white people in my life. And so I went back. They came over to the house and talked with us, and they invited us to come back again. And I went back the next weekend, the next meeting night, which was that following week, and that's the night I was nominated to be chairperson.
I'll be there.
Yeah, I was chairperson of the welfare committee,
but
just that quick.
But that must have been quite an experience for you.
It was.
I mean, a revelation.
It was, you know, all I had heard, my encounter with white people in my growing up, I did not live around white people. I lived, like I said, in a black community. I grew up in St. Louis, but my relatives, my grandmother comes from the South. And all I would hear about is how they were treated by people, white people down there. They lived on the plantations, and how they have to say yes sir and no sir. So this is what I knew about white people, that you stay in your place with them down South. But I didn't think it was like that in St. Louis, you know, because I never run into them.
But
well,
now you come to these people, and they're applauding you, and you name the chairperson.
Yeah, that was really, you know, what was most exciting, that somebody wanted me. I didn't even know what a chairperson was.
Yeah.
And someone wanted me to, I could speak, you know. One thing I had a lot inside me, I always wanted to say, but I never knew how to get it out. I didn't used to be a person who would speak out a lot.
That's the first time you spoke publicly.
Right, right.
And just flowed out of you.
Yeah, just because I was angry that night, so it just came out real easy.
And then we're talking now about
66.
And now, what happened? You're working together.
I found in later years that the way the system has programmed all of us, we all come from somewhere where we are taught to think a whole lot of different thoughts about people that you really don't know anything about. And you just fix it in your mind that they're like that. And we found in John, that's one of the things I like, is because I found out that poor white people ate like poor black people. Eat food. They eat greens. They eat all chitlins, everything we would eat. I mean, me and this lady could talk about it. I say, you all eat that? Yeah. And they eat grits. And, well, you eat that? Yeah. You know, then we find that, They were living in some of the worst apartments than we were.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Tonight we're listening to the work of Studs Terkel and memorializing him. This is self-proclaimed bootleg minister Will D. Campbell.
Give up some of the power. That's all I say. That is some kind of a bootleg and kooky, and I think radical Christian, going back to the Anabaptists, my anarchy genes start raising their romantic hitch here, that, that you know, the call that the prophets, as well as Jesus, called for was not for us to get more power and say, if we had the political power, we would run it. But the call was really to relinquish the power that we do have.
Mm.
And okay.
How do you get people to do that?
Well, it's not easy. And that goes back to, I think, that what is going to happen in this country is another movement of some type. Now, what form that will take is frightening to me, because I don't see a Gandhi-type movement on the horizon.
Mm.
How would it work? Mm. What I see is people on the streets, and what I see is some pretty bleak times ahead, but the power will be, I think, at some point, wrestled and redistributed.
Yeah, that's the thing. What do you see? So you're As I see Will Campbell, look at this. It's not a question of the usual thing of optimism, pessimism. You see a bleak outlook. But someone like something yet untapped. There was this guy who died, a white guy. He was a working man. And I had him in several books. He's going to be my epilogue. He says, you know, there's something missing in this stew. There's certain ingredient missing. He was against the blacks originally. He changed his mind as he went along gradually. You know why? Because I was thinking about it. We don't think enough. And thinking is so great. It's so exciting when you're thinking, an idea hits you, you know.
Yeah.
And so you're saying we haven't thought this thing really through.
I think we really have not yet diagnosed the problem. We have not acknowledged, and this is where this goes back to, let's blame the rednecks.
Mm-hmm.
We have never acknowledged the degree of negrophobia that has plagued this country from the very beginning, when we took it away from some dark-skinned people, committed genocide to hold on to it, fought two wars to expand it, bought and sold dark-skinned people to build it. And it was true of Abraham Lincoln, God knows, the great emancipator, who was not your basic old-fashioned integrationist by a long sight. We have never acknowledged that the disease, and until we do, we're not going to find an antidote for it.
Yeah. Now, in the South, the changes have been considerably more than they have up North, haven't they?
Oh, there's no question about that. I think my home state of Mississippi has, maybe we had further to go, I'm sure we did, but there have been more changes in that state, I think, than any state in the Union that I go into.
Yeah.
I was just talking a while ago when you called with William Winter, who was a very progressive governor, and who God knows did the best he could to inch us forward. But about all he could do was give people room to struggle. And that's what Barnett and those people would not allow. When I was chaplain at the University of Mississippi in 1954, 55, there wasn't room to struggle, you know, for me to say, look.
Well, you were chaplain at the University of Mississippi at Ole Miss.
Yeah.
Were you? 54, 55.
54 to 56.
And then you got in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my most radical statement was, our position was, look, if everyone in the state, black and white, thought that this Supreme Court decision was just right and necessary, it would still take us 20 years to work out the sheer logistics of it. That made me a left-winger, you know,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't talk about 20 years. They talked about never.
Never,
this
yeah.
was lunacy, and now...
So that's all gone. That never is gone.
Yeah.
And so there... So I guess the main attentions are in northern cities, you know.
Yeah.
Or large cities in the South, but northern primarily, you know. So it wasn't... Well, we think of the southern problem. Not that the changes have been probably far more far-reaching there than up north.
Yeah, well, I never believed that. When I was active in the movement such as I was, I never went around, you know, cussing the decadent South, nor did I say, you know, the North is worse than we are, though it was quite obvious to me, but I'm a Southerner, and so
yeah.
I'm trying to solve the problems down here. But in hindsight, I well remember that, you know, when I would go down, even to Mississippi, when it wasn't safe for me to go, I don't say I wasn't afraid, but when I would go to the large industrial areas of the North and the Midwest, and the cab driver locks all the doors when he crosses a certain
mm-hmm.
block, I remember thinking, these people are not ever going to solve their problem because they don't know one another.
Studs Terkel brought conversations to the table. He was smart, but he didn't use that as a way to gain power or come across as some educated journalistic jargon jibber-jabberer. He asked real questions whose answers he cared about knowing and whose purpose was to inspire dialogue between people. In all of his conversations, Studs Terkel reminds us of the universal truths that weave through all of our experiences. Struggle, love, loss, determination, with a sharp focus on race, class, and justice. The following excerpt is a conversation with Studs Terkel, Ellen Afterman, Spellman Young, and Clint Sanders, talking about drugs and who benefits from them.
Some people in authority, this is the establishment and authority, really don't mind it being here then.
Oh, I don't. You see, you have to deal with the type of person, the type of people that make up the police force. You know, they're usually second or third generation immigrants who probably, if they hadn't went into this phase of work, would have probably starved to death or went into the steel mill somewhere, you know. Right. And here you deal again with the capitalistic system, you know. I mean, this thing about advancing, having some scratch. I mean, the only way that the status symbol comes into effect here. So here you take a guy who's probably a patrolman and who probably would have no other means of ever owning a home, owning anything else in this country, and everything is, the basis on everything is owning, possession, you know. He sees an opportunity to maybe rake off $1,000 a week from the black kid who's dealing in the area, in the black area, you know. He doesn't hesitate. Now, what effect did this have on a black teenager seeing a white nailer come into his area taking money from a black male daily? And when this same cop turns around and tells him maybe move off the street, there's no respect there. How can it possibly be? Because they're in the same bag, and he realizes that the only thing that separates him from the black is his skin.
Hey, I made a buy many years ago in New York of a half an ounce of heroin. Turned out to be pure quinine. But I made the buy. I discovered it was pure quinine 3 seconds later when I got two steps away from the apartment door, went back to knock on the door and discovered it was a real setup. It was an empty apartment. The guy had gone out the window. Saw him on the street the next day, and I was high, and the drugs told me I could be bad. And I went up to him and said, hey. I went up to him and said, hey, you know, you beat me yesterday for $150. And he opened up his coat, and there was his badge and his gun.
Ah,
he said, what do you want to do about it?
This is known as a cliffhanger. Right? Ellen Afterman is telling a very fascinating story. I wanted to continue in a moment with Spellman Young and with Clint Sanders here in a minute. Talking about drugs. And these are two people who know from autobiography, their own experiences, and Clint from his very close observations. And we'll continue with Ellen's stories. Who benefits from the nature of hard drugs around and about us all? In a moment, we'll continue. In picking up the conversation with Ellen Afterman and Spellman Young and, why do I have a hang up about Clint's last name? Sanders, it is.
Sorry.
Clint Sanders. I think of that N. That's a good N, where the Los Angeles Rams named Sanders, too. But back to the question, Ellen, you were talking about you were taken, and that guy turned out to be
a narcotics cop.
Yeah.
Sure he did. What options did I have? What could I have done? Could I have gone down and sworn out a warrant? What could I do about it? But, you know, that was blatant. We've been held up by cops. We've been, you know, we've all known this for a long time. See, whenever you've got a situation that's obviously occurring over a long period of time, you've got to look at who benefits from it. You know, you do the same thing with racism. You do the same thing with sexism. Who is in power? Who is getting the goodies from this situation existing? So you talk about hard narcotics in this country. Obviously, somebody is invested in their continuing. Because in this tremendously advanced age of technological developments and fine minds, I mean, they can computerize everything now, right? They know you from the cradle to the grave.
Mm-hmm.
But they just can't seem to stop the drug traffic. Right. That's nonsense.
Right. Especially if you're familiar with this city and seeing how it was stopped on the north side, you know. And, you know, I can remember a few years back, maybe 9 or 10 years back, you had these nailers who were, you know, very famous. You know, I think they had the highest narcotic arrest than any other nailers in the city, you know.
Nailer is a...
Policeman.
Nailer.
Policeman. And it turned out that two of the three in the car were connects.
Sure.
Two of the three. So this is what they were actually doing. Their arrests were so high because simply they were going into the black areas, busting the black connects on the south side and carrying it to the west side.
Mm. And dealing themselves.
Right.
But you have to make it very clear of the alternatives that are open to these people. What we were talking about before, what alternatives are open to a lower middle class male in our society? You know, this is one of the ways he can make it. And if he's going to do this job, a narc works really hard. You know,
right.
And if he's going to do it, it has to have some kind of meaning. So he gets meaning laid on him from the people on top of him.
And so the question is, we're talking about a narc, a cop, we're going over and beyond this, as Ellen was saying, of course it could be stopped. So we're talking about organized crime itself, the syndicate, don't we?
We're talking about
how difficult it is, it would seem. It seems strange, isn't it? How difficult to stop the syndicate, when perhaps there's a connection to the syndicate and authority.
Oh, it is.
Perhaps?
I said perhaps.
Did
just
you?
To
okay.
It is, because, you know, once again, you You take the black area, for an example, you know, where you actually have had Nellis actually shotgunning connects. I mean, actually looking out for him, and it's coming straight from the family, the local family, you know. I mean, just say like you're getting maybe two or three keys from a family, you know. Well, you might actually have Nellis working in your area who are shotgunning you, who are watching you for the family, and who's getting a kickback. There's even been reference to Nellis actually being assassins who killed blacks who didn't pay the family off.
But you see, again, you can make the mistake of focusing on drugs as being the definition of the problem, and they're not, Studs. Because everything we're talking about, you know, when Clint talks about what options are open to a white, lower middle class male, other than either going into the mills or moving upward, becoming a cop, which is a status job.
Right.
When you talk about what options are open in the black community other than the attempt to mimic that which they see on television and hear around them as being desirable goals, You're calling into question the entire foundation of our culture.
Aren't you? Yeah, of course.
And of course, that's what the young kids are doing now. And that's why we have to keep on saying that drugs have different meanings for different people. That for some of the young white middle class kids that are using a variety of chemicals, it's an attempt to move out from the structure. It's an attempt to challenge that structure. It's also a search for intimacy. It's a way of making contact, of building cohesion, group cohesion.
In a time of so much impersonality.
Of course. You know, that's why you'll find, I think we can find, that in the black communities, there's a decline, at least in the incidence of new addiction, as the communities begin to recognize what has been laid on them, who is benefiting by their drug use. So that you find two things happening. You find it going down in the black communities and up in the white communities. For basically the same reasons, but with totally different results.
Right.
White young kids are getting it together to challenge the structure, and one of the ways they're challenging it is by their use of drugs. Young blacks are getting it together to challenge the structure, and one of the ways they're doing that is by keeping drugs out. All right? It's why the chemical itself is not the definition of a problem. You've got to understand what that means in terms of the entire social fabric and the political fabric and the racial fabric.
It comes back to that again, doesn't it? The question of everyone, those who are in harness, whether it be the black kid or the woman or the father or the guy who leaves home out of a necessity or desperation, or the lower class, the middle class, lower middle class, white kid, ethnic kid, who may become a cop to get out of it, too.
Right.
And work as a laborer in the mill.
Right. Sure, the white kid is colonized in the same way the black...
Of course.
The black is, you know. What does he have? The white kid now can't even get together with his own kind, you know. We close down all the places where kids go, right? A black, a homosexual, they can go be with their own people. But as soon as a white kid does that, the police close the place down.
So the coffee houses become suspect.
Right. The coffee houses, the parks. You listen to the reports from any of the Southwest Side, you know, grease kids, and they'll tell you that there's no place they can go except the local McDonald's, and every time they go in there, three squad cars pull up behind them.
Yeah, and you know, I think another thing that gasses, you know, probably the average young black is when, you know, the young white kid who's using drugs, you know, he's saying, because there's so much hypocrisy around, you know, and we say something like, oh, you finally hear,
huh? Is there really?
You know, you're playing catch up.
Yeah.
You know, because I think this is the thing that has, you know, really hangs the establishment up the most. You know, because they're saying, now look at all these goodies, you know, we've taken from you, you know, in order to, you know, and stashed them in order for you to take, you know, I mean, when you come of age, you know, and you're saying you're turning your back on these stolen, plundered goodies. You don't want them. You know, I think it's kind of hard for the establishment to adjust to that, you know. And I think this is why they are beaten and kicked in the streets.
Sure.
A matter of playing catch-up, you say. So that black kids, oh, you finally caught up. Now, if you think of the Chicago Democratic Convention, when it was white kids primarily who were beaten suddenly, and crying, I know, young black and saying,
well,
what's
you
new?
Finally realize
what
that, you know, that Officer Friendly is not the...
What else is
smiling?
So we come back to the question of over and beyond. The drug is merely the symptom we're talking about
of
here.
Of many problems, right. Not of one. Let me tell you an interesting story. Some years back, a group of people were tripping together. It was about six white and two blacks. Oh. And for the two blacks, it was their first trip. Okay, for the whites, they had been not using for some time, but before that, they had all used a great variety of psychedelic drugs. Everybody had a good trip, but what was really fascinating was about 3 hours into the trip, the two black guys got into a a heavy discussion. They were sitting on the living room floor, and the floor was somewhat littered with, you know, coffee cups and potato chips and ashtrays and stuff, because nobody was paying much attention to that as they were tripping. The two guys got into a heavy discussion about a garbage can. You know, they started off by saying, look at this, man, we're sitting in the middle of this garbage can, right? Mm-hmm. And they were talking about the teacups and the coffee cups and stuff. But from there it went on, and for 4 hours, the two of them ran a rap about the garbage can they were in.
Mm-hmm.
Now remember, they were high,
yeah.
Right? But that rap was a direct parallel to their life, okay? Right. They covered everything. Mm-hmm. They covered the cops, the social workers, the people who come in to interview, you know, mm-hmm. please don't survey me no more,
mm-hmm.
you know? They did the whole thing about
yeah.
welfare.
Yeah.
You know, about as soon as you make yourself a little nice, comfortable place in the garbage, you know, you can't expect too much, but at least it's yours. Somebody want to come in and mess over it and raise it and put up a housing project,
yeah.
right? And they want to move you around, tell you to go live somewhere
right.
else,
yeah. right.
you know, and they messing with my garbage, and at least it's my garbage,
yeah.
you know, and they carried that on for 4 hours, and it was the most poetic, most painful thing I've ever heard.
So they reenacted the actual
That's
situation,
right.
the overall situation.
That's right. Yeah. And that was the parallel. That was the only metaphor they could
yeah.
find.
Yeah.
Studs Terkel spent time with workers who survived the Great Depression. This excerpt is a conversation with Frank Cherwanka, celebrated garbage man and hobo from Chicago, Illinois.
At that time, there was a lot of the old-time hobos, bums. I mean, they had a circuit they would follow. I mean, like a preacher or a salesman, he had a route, and he, more or less, the town knew him. I mean, he knew the good jails to spend the winter in. And they would associate with each other, be clannish about it. They wouldn't let in outsiders very much. There were a number of people out of work, and then you get in these small towns. The men be sitting around on the front porch, or they'd be hanging around a local pool room or the county building, whatever it was, there were a tremendous amount of people standing around doing nothing. I mean, and nobody had any money. I mean, in them days, if you got lucky and you got yourself a package of cigarettes, Camels was that bit, you put them in your socks and your bull durham was in your shirt, shoes, the shirt bucket. So the other ones that didn't have it would mooch the bull durham instead of Camels. After all, Camels cost anywhere from 11 to 14 cents.
So therefore,
in them days, you could take a girl out for a dollar. In the evening, you could go to a dime show. After that, you'd go to a nickel hamburger joint, have a couple of hamburgers and coffee, and you still have enough money to go to the tavern for a couple of beers. And then you bought three beers, the house would pop for the fourth one.
Mm.
So for a dollar, you could have a good evening.
And the hometown guys were standing around. What was that feeling about strangers? You know, the hobos, the guys you passed through? Was there
well, in these towns, they didn't particularly care for the bums. They wouldn't talk to them. And because they're afraid they'd get mooched, bummed. There were always people bumming. I mean, be back doors knocking down there, trying to get a hand out. I've done some of it myself. I had to.
You know which houses to knock into or which houses to
knock into? No, this bit about the code that the old bums had. It broke down, I mean, then. And they were still in use. They weren't letting the newcomers, the novel poppers.
The nouveau paupers, I like that word.
I started work. Then I worked there, and the funny thing about it, I got laid off a week before the Depression, but I knew the man had a bad memory, so I kept working for another week.
Uh-huh.
And the day that the stock market broke, I got laid off.
1929.
Yeah.
And so it was life pretty good for you till that crash?
I mean, I had everything I wanted. I didn't want much, though. That's the secret of success, I guess. All my life's ambition was to be a bum. I failed at it. We had a speakeasy going. Well, there's a bunch of people. They moved in, took this second story flat. These moonshiners, these people down here, they got gas company men to tap the gas main with 3-inch pipe. You're using the gas company men material. I mean, they take money, too, you know.
Oh, go ahead.
They came in there, and they're using the gas company equipment, tools and everything, official. They just tapped the gas main pipe and ran it up to the second floor, put a burner on it, put a 100-gallon still on it, and it was going 24 hours a day, just time off to put a new batch in.
So the gas bill, of course, this wasn't added to the gas bill.
No, they had no meter on it. They had barrels with the mash all over the place. And one day, Your stepfather gets drunk and disorderly. He was a goofy that way. He liked to get arguments going and get pounded up. And they didn't object to it, so they asked my mother if it's all right to kill him. She said, no, I haven't got insurance on him.
She didn't have insurance on him?
Studs Terkel died in Chicago this past October. He was 96 years old.
According to his son, he died peacefully at his home in Chicago.
William Grimes of the Herald Tribune recently wrote, in his oral histories, which he called guerrilla journalism, Terkel relied on his enthusiastic but gentle interviewing style to elicit in rich detail the experiences and thoughts of his fellow citizens.
Someone says, do you believe in immortality? I said, yes, I do. For example, a guy stopped me one day on the Michigan Avenue Bridge. He'd read Working, and it was a profile of a waitress. And he said, having read that book, I'll never again talk the way I did to a waitress because of that woman, Dolores Dante. Well, I said, that's fantastic. That means I've touched him. So he'll live far longer than I do. He was about 50 years younger than me. So if I'm dead, he's around with a little touch. And he might touch someone else. So that's immortality, I think.
Studs just loved people deeply, profoundly, and with endless enthusiasm.
Author Sidney Lewis worked with Terkel at WFMT and transcribed many of his interviews.
You know, I would listen and I would be observing as I was typing, and suddenly someone would just open this floodgate inside themselves, and I'd think, what is it that he did? What did he say? What did he ask that made this happen? It was not any one thing ever. It was just something about his presence and the attention and interest and genuine, really deep curiosity that he brought.
I'm not a religious person myself, but it is kind of like the religion of Studs, to kind of get something out of life.
All the years we're told, well, let's not talk about bad. Remember in the old days, somebody would say, we don't discuss politics or religion, meaning, of course, you don't discuss life, or we don't discuss sex, or we don't discuss death. People want to talk about it once you open the gates, that life is finite, and therefore, it being finite, it's precious.
Thanks to Dave Roach, the Chicago Historical Society, and studsterkel.org for the archive of audio we've used to put the show together. Circle A Radio airs every first and third Wednesday here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. You can contact us or listen to past shows at kbu.fm/circlearadio. Our next show airs January 7th. Thanks for listening.
I'm curious, you know, my epitaph, I hope, will be, curiosity did not kill this cat.